Hello, HPR audience. This is CoCruncher and Phinux. We're kind of chatting today. This is the first time we're actually talking. It's strange to talk to a stranger, but Phinux, why don't you start by also greeting the audience?
Hello, podcast listeners. It's been a while since we've been on HBR, but yeah, it's nice to speak with you, CoCruncher. How are you?
I'm fine. You said you're in sunny Dundee. I'm in rainy Vancouver, so that's quite a contrast, I guess.
I suppose it stands to show how diverse the HPR community actually is.
Yes, that's true. So I have a question for you, because I'm only listening to HPR like starting last October, so I haven't really heard many of your shows at HPR before you started then doing your own show. I always thought that HPR is actually a good way to get started with podcasting and then do your own show. Just wondering how that is working out for you.
I mean, I have such a love-hate relationship with podcasting, if truth be told. I've talked about podcasting before, like at Software Freedom Day and all of that sort of stuff, and I'm a big fan of podcasting, and I've always said that you should that HPR is an ideal way to get into podcasting. And I was once given some advice by the HPR god himself, Klaatu, that said, you know, you shouldn't really start your own podcast. You should always do it through like syndicate through HPR and that sort of stuff. And for some silly reason, I just didn't take the advice. And I've had two podcasts in the end that I've started up like through HPR. TrackSec, that didn't, you know, that made about four episodes. And Phoenix Tech Weekly. But sometimes it's very hard because of your outside commitments to be able to do it. But we're getting Phoenix Tech Weekly back on, and it's a lot of fun. In the flip side, if I'm struggling getting that out, it makes it hard sometimes for me to podcast at HPR. And HPR's always been like my first podcasting love. I've loved the community, loved everything about it. If you want to get into podcasting, there is no better way than using HPR, definitely, without doubt.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, I never thought I would ever do podcasting before the last time that Ken actually was desperate to get shows in and I recorded my show on how I got into Linux.
Yeah, I think Ken's put in some really nice features. A lot of good work's gone into HPR. I haven't really been much of an active member for a while, just with outside stuff, but like the... they have that number that you can call in and record podcasts with. I think
wonderful.
That was a fantastic addition. The syndicate Thursdays, I think that's a really good idea. I mean, HPR's come on leaps and bounds this year, and yeah, definitely. I have to stick my hands up. I'm a HPR fanboy. Like, there's no two ways about it. But yeah, so people at home, if you get bored, you should start recording episodes. It could be just as easy as getting two geeks on Skype, I suppose.
We probably have to tell the audience the reason why we're doing this show now is because Ken kind of saw the queue getting too empty and was putting out the call in the mailing list for shows. So you said you have something to talk about, and I said I have time to record and edit it. So now we're doing it.
It's awesome.
And, I mean, we did have a little pre-show, very short chat through Facebook to kind of agree on one or two topics. Shall we start with the botnet topic?
Yeah, certainly.
So maybe I give a little introduction how that actually came up, because I was listening to your last Phoenix Tech Weekly. There you mentioned that in Canada there was a 53% increase in command and control servers for botnets. But then in Phoenix Tech Weekly there was this pause of 5 seconds or something. And during that time a lot of questions piled up in my head, and I decided to go online and do a little bit of research about why is it in Canada and what happened. The information I got is not, there isn't that much information.
No,
The reason,
there's not
as... sorry?
No, there's not, is there? And it's an interesting question. Why Canada and nowhere else? So what's the, what have you come across? I mean, it seems to me that...
How this number came out is because this company, let me see if I wrote it down somewhere.
WebSense,
yeah. There is this guy, Patrick Ronald, and they started looking into this issue after they decided to invest the situation that they were seeing an increase in targeted attacks against the Canadian government. That's the reason why they looked into the numbers, and they saw an increase of 53% in the botnets, I mean, in the command and controls, and over 300% increase in spyware, no, phishing networks or phishing attacks. Mm-hmm. So it's a huge increase coming from Canada. But I mean, one of the first questions I have is like, how do you really identify and count command and control servers? Because they are dormant most of the time, aren't they?
Yes and no. It's an interesting question. I mean, we have to take whatever statistics come out of this with a pinch of salt. Because it's one commercial entity's outlook on what they're seeing through their data, which they collect in their ways of doing. So it's not been independently verified, to say mm-hmm. the least. So WebSense is seeing what it considers to be a command and control, which could very well be legitimate, but it is what WebSense sees as a command and control. Now, this is not to say that there isn't an increase in it, but command and control would be if someone is to get infected, Configer was a prime example of this sort of stuff, that the botnet needs to speak back home. So by code analysis, you can say, right, this piece of evil code contacts this server in some way, shape, or form. It will be hard-coded, either an IP address or a domain name or something like that. And that's where they'll say there's a command and control center in Canada, because they'll be doing an IP lookup, so to speak, of. Does that sort of make sense?
It does, but I mean, there are also these command and control centers that kind of have an algorithm, on a time-based algorithm for finding the connection. So it may actually not necessarily be hard-coded or easy to identify that a certain calculation results in an IP number or something.
Yeah, I mean, in the end, the point for delivering control has to be, I mean, no matter how much you encrypt it, at the end, it's got to be decrypted. You mm-hmm. know, no matter what, mm-hmm. there is an exit point and an entry point.
Yeah.
And that software has to speak to an exit point at some point, and that has to, the nature of it, you can make it more difficult, so on and so forth. That's not to say, though, that a van load of cyber criminals rolled into Canada. I mean, this is the bit that I found very hard to get my head around, that trying to make this localization of the problem. And the internet isn't like that. It doesn't work that way. And I think WebSense did a very strange job as well, because they picked on Canada, but they failed to say that America is still the number one mm-hmm. host of phishing data. You know, Canada is number two. You know, mm-hmm. maybe there isn't such a surprise that if the biggest country in the world producing this stuff is your next door neighbor, maybe there is going to be an overspill. You know, I don't think that it's... I was very dubious about it on the show, I have to be honest with you.
I mean, they talk a little bit. I mean, there's like... they have different numbers in their statistic. And I'm gonna post the link in the show notes. So Canada is number two now for phishing sites, and it moved from 13 to 6th for the botnets, I think. Well, there are two reasons. One reason they talk about why the U.S. is leading, and that is just because a lot of the servers are in the U.S. I mean, it's like really you have a huge infrastructure there, so that also means high numbers for everything. And then they talk about two botnets that were taken down in the U.S., and that's why maybe the people moved to Canada, and because the law enforcement is cracking down on botnets more in the U.S. currently.
It's just a transient issue. I mean, if you squeeze one end, it's going to pop up at the other end. I mean, at the end of the day, I suppose the relieving point is that if they're saying that this is due to the Rostock and Core flood botnets being taken down, what they're ultimately trying to say with this sort of argument is that there actually hasn't been an increase in any cybercrime whatsoever. It's just been moved. So there isn't more cyber criminals. Just the problem is, and you can only do crackdowns for a certain amount of time as well. I wouldn't be surprised if we saw this sort of number drop and move about. Maybe what we're really going to start seeing now is a transient cybercrime bubble just popping about and moving to different countries and so on and so forth. I don't know if this is going to be like a permanent problem for Canada. I'm not 100% sure on that.
Well, it's a problem that's not going to go away. I mean, you're not saying that the number is going to drop overall. It's just the ranking maybe change again.
Yeah, there's no doubt that the issue needs to be looked at. I mean, at the end of the day, if you've got cyber criminals using your infrastructure, at some point there is always going to be a problem. And it is up to governments to regulate that sort of issues. The government are going to have to look at what they can do to make sure that they come out of that situation and what appropriate actions the government can take at their level. Because if it's easy to commit cybercrime in Canada, you'll not be surprised if you have cyber criminals move in. I suppose that's almost like common sense.
Yeah, that's something I read in like the comments by different people on the articles that I looked at, that the Canadian government really isn't doing much or doesn't have good structures in place to actually deal with cyber criminals.
And that's not particularly unusual. I used to do I was involved in an ethical hacking degree, and we, at the beginning, we did a lot of learning about how laws take a long time to catch up with what's happening technologically related, a massive time. There was times where, like, cybercrime in the UK wasn't very well regulated, and times in America. It's a very interesting book recommended by a friend of mine called The Cuckoo's Egg by Clifford Strohl. It's an awesome book. It's a true story. They basically had hackers, this is years and years ago, maybe I think it was in the 70s or something like this, had hackers breaking into systems. But the American, like into like Milnet and all of this sort of stuff, I mean, they had some serious intrusion going on. But they didn't have the laws to actually get the FBI involved. The FBI couldn't get involved unless it was $1 million in crime. So the problem with laws, the thing is that they don't, it's easy to write a patch, but it's not so easy to write a law. And you have to get it through courts and votes and so on and so forth. So, it's an ever-changing state. It's a tough problem. I wouldn't want to be a government trying to fix what's legal and not legal. Certainly in cyberspace.
Cyberspace, because it's global and it's really hard to deal with it on a like country by country level.
Well, packets don't know borders. No. That's the long story short. You know, mm-hmm. they they don't care if they were sent from Canada, or they don't care if they were received in America. That, you know, mm-hmm. but unfortunately, those states have to have some level of control. Not much you can do about that, I suppose.
Another question that came to my mind is, like, I mean, you have the command and control servers, and then you have the zombie computers, right, that they mm-hmm. can contact.
Yeah.
How can you find out if your computer is a zombie?
Numerous of ways. But it's all, you all have to, it's kind of like a per situation basis, I suppose. Mm-hmm. I suppose what you need to understand is if you've been compromised, exactly what a compromise is. It's probably easier to look at it that way. Mm-hmm. Change in performance, instability of your system, because obviously bad guys don't care if they break APIs in your system or libraries or any of that mm-hmm. stuff. That, you know, they don't care.
Yeah.
Also, strange network activity, definitely a big giveaway of something's going on. So, mm-hmm. yeah, I mean, firewalls are good at picking their stuff up. If, you know, if mm-hmm. if you're running semi-decent firewall stuff, yeah, you'll be... It's good. Linux, obviously, in a lot of ways, is, in my opinion, a little bit ahead of the game on that. But I also think that Windows, their own firewall that they're... I mean, I don't use Windows systems anymore, and I haven't done for years. But the last time I knew they had a firewall in XP, and that seems to have been pretty good from most of the research I did at the time. Mm-hmm. So these things will help. At the end of the day, if your zombie can't communicate with its command and control, then... it's still a zombie, you know, it's not an active player anymore, mm-hmm. so, yeah, mm-hmm. but yeah, there's a big, they're interesting. I mean, it's something that we talk about, obviously, when I speak to people not involved in hacking, or I'm the first hacker that they've met, and the conversations ultimately always start off with, you know, how can hacking be ethical, blah, 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 but mm-hmm. eventually what happens is people start saying, well, I've got nothing to hide, so no one's going to hack me. You know, this. I'm only a small fish. There's plenty of other fish in the sea, so I'm not, you know, I'm not a target. I've got nothing for them to target. And it's this point that I always come back to. It's these zombie machines, and you can inadvertently be involved in cybercrime. The Russian mafia have been reported to have used botnets to take down gambling websites during live matches. So they would say to basically an extortion racket, mm-hmm. You will pay us £25,000 during the Arsenal-Chelsea soccer match, or we will DDoS your site during that match. And if you don't believe us, we'll take your site off now. And they knock the site over. And then the gambling companies only have two choices, really. They either pay or they don't pay. Mm-hmm. And obviously, if your business is taking online bets during sporting events, you being off during a major sporting event is a massive issue. But yeah, I mean, that's an example of you being used purely as a resource. People don't understand that. That mm-hmm. people tend to think that as a target, a bad guy's interested in your data. It's not always the case. Sometimes a bad guy's interested in your resources, such as your bandwidth, such as your machine, so on and so forth.
So gambling sites, that's an interesting one, because, I mean, there is a lot of money involved, so you can really also probably get a lot of money.
The only reason we know about it is one of the gambling sites refused to pay. And got knocked off.
Wow.
We don't know how many actually paid prior to that. So it could have been the first one. They could have just got caught. Or, you know, or it could be one in many. That's for sure. I certainly know of companies and organizations in the UK that have paid money, extortion money, for data not to be. I know of a university in London that paid three times before they called in the police.
Wow.
So, yeah. That's crazy. So we don't know. I mean, like I say, it's only one that we know about. So it's either widespread or not. But yeah, it's an example of using the situation. And they don't just target online gambling sites. I mean, at the end of the day, you could inadvertently, by being part of a botnet, be involved in lots of different stuff. Anonymous, a prime example. Mm-hmm. Interesting case, Anonymous. Willingly infecting themselves with a botnet that certainly would take any of your protection, certainly under any UK law, that certainly you wouldn't have any protection under the law in that mm-hmm. situation. Mm-hmm. None at all. And I would be surprised under many, many many countries that you would be protected under the law with that.
As I know, you don't have protection in the US either. I mean, that's what I heard on other podcasts that I'm listening to.
I think the long story short is most laws are based on intent anyway. The intent to commit a crime is the criminal act itself. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you knowingly using yourself as a tool to knock over PayPal or Amazon, you knew what you were doing. It doesn't matter if you were a small cog in a big machine. At the end of the day, your intent was to cause damage. So, you know, if your laws can support those arguments, you as we would say in the UK, you're bang to rights.
Yeah. There is also the other side of the story. I mean, it's an amazing kind of, you know, invention to actually have computers control other computers and have them do a lot of things. I think the most, like, extreme botnet that I remember was the Estonia attack, where they actually took down a whole country.
I mean, there's lots of cases about this. Bruce Schneider is on a little bit of a rant about this stuff recently, and I have to agree with him. The problem with cyber warfare in this kind of context is that you should never really use the term war unless it does refer to you know, bombs and bullets and death, because it desensitizes people. There is no, you know, nothing's happening now, and so nothing happened to Estonia that hasn't happened before. There was nothing new in what happened here. You know, it just had a name. That's all that happened. At the end of the day, if you talk about this in a warfare context, right, the reality of what happened in Estonia was an invading army invaded a country and filled up all the queues in the supermarket. That's the equivalent of what they did. You know, they turned off some services. Yes, it was a pain in the bum, but no one, you know, they occupied services. That's all they did. And it's not really, you know, what we should be starting to see, and we have been starting to see, is more cyber components being deployed during warfare. But yeah, the term, the Estonia thing is, you know, it was done for no other reason than to annoy Estonia. You know, let's be perfectly, it was designed to be the ultimate Nagua. But yet we see, I mean, you want to talk about like cyber warfare, we see cyber weapons. That's what we're seeing. We see this with, you know, Stuxnet. Mm-hmm. I mean, alleged blah, 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 blah. But let's be honest about this. This software attacked not only a specific nuclear reactor, a specific nuclear refinement facility, but a specific reactor within the facility, right? So that code was very specifically written for a target. No two ways about it. It had an auto kill switch, all of these sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, so I'm going to make my opinion that that's cyber, that, you know, that's a cyber weapon.
Yeah.
And what we need to start talking about in terms of war, because this is the problem when you say things like cyber war, is that an act of war? You know, is that cyber attack an act of war? You know, that was a cyber weapon that went off. You know, and unless we drop the cyber warfare malarkey and start talking about it in the context of what it is, and stop with this media hype about it all, and start being a little bit more realistic about it, we're going to get into crazy situations based on DOSes. I mean, we've seen cyber components being used in warfare for quite a while. I believe the beginning of Gulf War One, we hacked into the Iraqis' air defenses and shut them off. You know, cyber components in warfare. The Allied forces.
Oh, okay.
I'm not sure if it was British or not. I'm not sure which ones did it. But yeah, they switched the radars off and then bombed. It's not unusual. We didn't call that cyber warfare.
Yeah.
You know, we called that war. So, yeah, that's my issue. And I don't mean to go on to a big rant about it.
It is really too bad that the terminology kind of distracts from what is actually going on and happening, and, you know, blurring the actual discussion about the technology and the potential. But, I mean, these incidents are wake-up calls and make us realize that there are vulnerabilities out there that are new because of our networked world.
A prime example is this internet kill switch. It's echo Bruce Schneider again on this one, but if you make a button that could turn off your internet as a bad guy, that's pretty much the button I want to press, and now I have a target. It's making a nuclear bomb because someone's got a nuclear bomb. It blows my mind how it even gets discussed. I mean, I have a friend who would say that it's that wrong, it's not even wrong anymore. And that's almost meaning that, you know, you couldn't be wrong if you tried. It's that far away from even sensible. God knows how they would even think about getting in. Well, I've got ideas about how they could implement something like that, but would you want it is such a different question. And in fairness as well, I mean, say America shut up shop for 24 hours, you know, what's the impact on the rest of the internet? Does the internet carry on or does it stop? Do we inadvertently lose all our services because of America presses a button? It's worrying times ahead, no doubt about it.
I kind of think that the internet is still going to survive even without the US, but the question is, like, how many services actually come from that country that we depend on and that don't, you know, have replicas outside that would survive.
It'd be interesting to see. If they make a kill switch, we might soon find out.
You think somebody will be tempted to find out?
Oh, yeah, it'd be the Holy Grail, wouldn't it? I mean, really, it's like the world's biggest target.
Yeah.
You know, it's not going to get bigger a target than I turned off America's internet. You know, it's the ultimate DOS.
Yeah, I never really thought about it that way, but it's intriguing. Okay, well, that was much longer answers to my questions that I had regarding this botnet thing in Canada.
You should just tell me to shut up when I ramble on, you know.
I think it was very interesting because, I mean, we're taking a risk here. We're having a discussion without actually knowing each other, and it works quite well. But there was another topic that you mentioned, which is something you talked about at meetings, which is tunneling over DNS.
DNS in class. Yeah. I've recently been talking a couple of it's not a new thing, but I've been talking about how it's possible to wrap up your communications into DNS inquiries and send them transfer them over DNS inquiries. So basically wrapping your IP traffic in DNS inquiries. And it wouldn't surprise people to know that there isn't many legitimate reasons why you would be doing this. But the reason for it is that it's a very effective means of bypassing captive portals or some firewalls as well. It's very handy at doing that. And the reality
Just explain DNS queries. Like, what is actually the information that is being sent in DNS queries?
What happens in DNS is DNS is the system that we use so that we have domain names that are memorable. Otherwise, we'd all have to remember number ranges. Mm-hmm. And people notoriously about it remembering those. So DNS is the system that we use to cover that. It stands for domain name service or system or something like that. Mm-hmm. And the idea is that there is, I think it's 16 or maybe 13 root DNS servers, and what they handle is the .coms, the .orgs, and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. And then the domain name part, which is like phoenix.co.uk, the my ISP would handle the resolution between getting the Phoenix bit and translating that to a number that refers to a system somewhere on the internet. Mm-hmm. So what happens in a DNS inquiry is pretty much one end, you have a request that goes out and says, I'm looking for www.phoenix.co.uk. And the system goes, okay, that ends in a co.uk. That root domain server holds that, will hold the information for that. Hi, where is Phoenix? Is okay, Phoenix is held by this domain name server, and this is his IP address. And that's pretty much how it should work. Mm-hmm. I've got some notes on it somewhere on the site and stuff like that, but I'll send you some stuff and you maybe stick them on the HPR site where mm-hmm. there's a better job of explaining DNS stuff. But basically DNS in requests in the end are your computer's way of asking the domain name server where a resource on the internet is.
So, and then you can use this for tunneling.
Yes, well, this is the interesting thing. I'm sure we've all... I'm going to talk about a captive portal, and it might be easier if I just mention it. Like, a captive portal is... I'm sure we've seen these wireless networks that you can sign up. You get on, it's an open wireless network, but you need to register to use the web. And what they tend to do, how they tend to work, is they tend to intercept HTTP requests. And until you pay for your service, it will intercept all those HTTP requests. However, it would seem, and has done for a long, long time, they do allow unfettered DNS requests. So what I've been able to do, and I'm not the only one in the world that's done it, and I'm only copying other people's work, really, is I've been able to wrap my HTTP traffic, which would be intercepted on these captive portals, and I've been able to wrap it up into DNS requests that aren't being intercepted by the captive portal, so I'm able to get point-to-point communication working over, but basically without them being able to, they can't see it, it's not being intercepted by them at all.
So I mean, the trick is to not use the HTTP protocol so that the other server cannot identify you as somebody who should pay.
Yeah, well, it doesn't see you. I mean, you're allowed to, you're working within the rules of that particular system. You're not exploiting anything per se. Mm-hmm. But what happens is, in this case, so I was able to establish quite easily an SSH session over a captive portal. I was able to establish an SSH session out of the captive portal to another machine and tunnel my traffic and everything like that as well. And what is interesting here is another vector, when I've talked about this before, and I talk about vectors, I'm really talking about uses. I mean, I'm supposed to be a bad guy for the good guys. That's ultimately what I'm supposed to be. So I'm supposed to think about how these things are attacked. And what's really handy is that as a bad guy, it's a very, very handy tool. It's easy to say, oh, we get free internet out of it. But the reality of it is that I can tunnel data out of your network over your DNS servers. Now, if you're not watching for that, you may have a very tight-up data lockup kind of policy, but I can bit by bit steal data out of your network over your DNS inquiries. Or I can tunnel. The great thing with DNS is very good at NAT traversing. It's a routable address. Mm-hmm. We can use it to establish illicit communications with a target. So we tunnel our attack code over DNS, and that's circumvents problems with that, and quite hard for it to be picked up as well. So yeah, I mean, there is a lot of interesting uses for it. But this came about in, God, this is not unknown. A bunch of German hackers, I think in 1998, used it to call into Microsoft's update service, and then they would tunnel their traffic, because it was a toll-free number at the time, just dial-up sort of days. But yeah, they were able to call into Microsoft's update service and then tunnel their IP traffic over DNS inquiries and get an internet connection, basically through a toll-free number, which was Microsoft's update server, and that was the beginning part of it. And then a very famous researcher called Dan Kaminsky released some tools, which my talk was based on slightly, called Ozyman DNS, which is really a set of Perl scripts that enable you to set this sort of setup up. It's quite easy, actually, to be honest with you. But you need a machine on the internet. That's the long story short of it. You need something to tunnel to.
Mm-hmm. Well, I feel like I have to go through my networking book again to actually understand how and which protocol you're really kind of exploiting here.
What you're ultimately doing is you're wrapping, this is quite a bit to get your head around as well, you're wrapping TCP/IP packets up in UDP.
Move them down.
Yeah. Oh, there's a whole lot of stuff that needs to be worked out. You're mm-hmm. exploiting, what you're really doing is you're exploiting, how it works is you can encode traffic in DNS requests. You get lots of different DNS sort of requests. So you can get a DNS request for a TXT file, which holds resources in. So what we're able to do is encode traffic into base64 and base32, sorry, and then re-encode it at the other end and then respond back with the request. Mm-hmm. So what you're really doing is sending structured DNS requests, because you can get up to the length of a DNS request, theoretically, you can get up to 255 bytes. So in mm-hmm. one DNS request, we can send an amount of bytes that dependable, but no more than 255, but probably a little bit less. And then the fake domain name server in the internet can respond back with a TXT file that has the appropriate response for our traffic. And that way we're able to send data from point to point. So you're exploiting the implementation of DNS more than anything else.
Yeah, I mean, because also HTTP requests, they kind of are in the end broken down into packets that get sent out and reassembled.
Yeah, I mean, the problem you have to overcome in reality is using UDP for something that it is completely incapable of doing.
Okay.
You know, problem UDP has no error checking. Mm-hmm. You drop a packet, you drop a packet. Mm-hmm. However, in a TCP/IP setup, that's not good voodoo. That's bad. So there is, you know, as a protocol hacker, you know, that's why I kind of really love that sort of stuff, because it's really insane to think that you've basically put a square peg in a round hole and made it work.
So two more questions. I mean, so if packets get dropped, do you just ignore them, or do you send or can you identify that they were dropped? Can you re-request them?
Yeah, there's a couple of tools out there that make this easy. Mm-hmm. Ozyman DNS is one of them, without doubt, probably the better one of the tools. And that is actually available on my site as well. I can't remember the location of it, mm-hmm. but I'll send it to you.
Okay.
And there's a few other tools, one called NSTX, which this is what the German hackers developed. And what this is able, what this does is it's a Linux tool, I think. I don't think you can get it for Windows. I could be wrong, though. And I don't think you can get it for Mac, but I think it's a Linux tool, and you're able to set up like a virtual network device on your machine, and you have like a fake domain name server out on the internet, and you can set up a virtual device on that machine as well, and you can set up a VPN, and it works that way. And that one's quite good. There's got quite a lot of protection built into it and stuff like that. I've been talking about it for a while, so you know, I've got some slides and stuff like that that'll be coming out in the next couple of weeks.
Okay.
Going over all of this stuff. Okay. And I spoke about it at B-Sides London, and I'm away to speak about it again in London at the beginning of June.
So the other question, you mentioned TXT files, so that's text files. Is there then, I mean, how much data can you actually transport this way? Is there a
255 limit? Bytes.
No limit
to it. If we talk about countermeasures to this sort of attack, there's countermeasures to the countermeasures, and it's one of these strange games of cat and mouse. But the reality of it is there's certain things that you can do. There isn't really a huge amount of legitimate reason for browser requests and that sort of stuff. It really, mail uses TXT quite a lot, you know, but you know, you shouldn't really need that. Your captive portals wise, you need to change DNS servers when you're, you know, you shouldn't allow recursive DNS lookups. This is how it ultimately works. So you're able to, what happens is, say we have evilserver.phoenix.co.uk. We do a DNS request to that. And what happens is we use a file setup, a DNS server setup that would say, all requests for this domain name, look at this domain name server for it. And that's kind of like a recursive lookup. And that's in part where the hack works, because of this recursive movement. It's very hard to explain over a podcast. I do try and explain it in my slides.
Yeah.
But the true hack in the implementation is two things, really, is this recursive lookup, because your DNS server can't, you as the legitimate person, captive portal or firewall or so on and so forth, you're only seeing the resource to evil.phoenix.co.uk. But what happens when that lookup happens is when they get to that domain server, that's the bit where it points to a different fake domain server that's encoding and decoding base64 and 34 encoded DNS requests. But you can't say block. If you get a million requests for a domain, block it. You just can't do that, because, you know, imagine like if you are a university that has a captive portal and requires your students to sign into the wireless network via their credentials. A lot of universities have this similar setup, and you'd be able to tunnel out of it.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem there is that you can't say, oh, well, if you get a million requests to Phoenix, block Phoenix. Because how many million requests do they get to Google? I mean, the problem is that you can't do, there's only certain things you can and can't do. I mean, you're only using functionality. That's the interesting problem. You're doing what the protocol in some ways was designed to do. You know, the TXT records, you know, you can send 255 bytes of data. That's exactly what you're doing. That's exactly what it was designed to do. There is problems. But, yeah, if you start to see a huge bandwidth go up on your port 53, yeah, might be time to start looking. Certainly, there's no two ways about it. You shouldn't see that much bandwidth or that much traffic. You know, really, a DNS request isn't a huge amount of data. It shouldn't be. You know, it's a lightweight protocol.
I can't remember what port 53 is standing for.
That's DNS, sorry.
That's DNS.
That's
okay.
Yeah,
okay.
That's the DNS code, sorry.
Okay, that's how the circle kind of closes. Yeah, this is really interesting, because it's kind of just exploiting the way things work. And, I mean, it's a typical hack, because you're taking what's there and making use of it.
Yeah, absolutely. All of the best hacks are implementation hacks. If the protocol's The problem is when you write something, DNS systems is an example of this, but this was written years and years ago. Mm-hmm. So we've had a lot of time to go over it and find weaknesses in it. Lots and lots and lots of years of doing that. And this is always the game that people play. You know, and you get there. And there's protocol hacking is really interesting.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I'm looking forward to actually see your slides because it is hard to imagine the whole thing without the graphic accompanying the whole explanation.
I had to do this talk at B-Sides London in 30 minutes from beginning to end. Now, it was recorded, but I don't know when it's going to be made available. Mm-hmm. But I have the slides, and like I say, I'm giving it again. But yeah, after that, the slides will be out. And I think the slides may be available on the B-Sides London website. Have a Google and see. I'll find out.
Yeah. If we can find them, we should put a link in the show notes.
Have I scared you with all the DNS tunneling talk?
No, you kind of. I'm curious now, and you know, these are the kind of podcasts that I really like at HPR when like I get information about something that I've never really thought about, and then can actually follow up and you know, maybe get more information, get to understand it better, or just it's thought-provoking in a lot of ways. That's what I like. But I am a little overwhelmed at this point, I have to admit. So being able to look at your slides will be good. Oh, you sent me the link. That's great.
Yeah, I just found the link there. So.
Okay, so we'll put that in the show.
If you have any more questions,
If I have more questions, we have to do another show because I think this one is already getting pretty long. I mean, much longer than I expected it would be. And maybe we should also mention that in your Finnox Tech Weekly, you actually talk about B-Sides London. So if people are interested in hearing more about it, they can probably just try to find your podcast, right?
Yeah, you can. We do a weekly podcast, but it's not been like that for a while. But yeah, you can find us at www.finnox.co.uk. We've past couple of episodes have been B-side sort of related, which is it's really been quite fun to be involved in all of that sort of stuff. So it's been a lot of fun. It was very nice to speak with you. Hopefully we can do it again someday.
Yes, this was very nice. I'm like glad that I was able to pick your brain about the botnets, which helped a lot. And thanks for jumping in. Thanks for offering to record a show for HPR.
No, thank you for wanting to do it. I've really enjoyed it, actually. It's been fun.
Okay, I think we have to say goodbye to our audience, and thanks for listening.
Yeah, thanks very much. And folks, don't forget, you could be making shows as well, so do take the opportunity to get on calls and talk to people and record things. And you know, it's a community podcast, and Ken needs the shows. So honestly, folks, stand up and be counted and get yourself recording a show. Thank you, Code Cruncher. You have a good day, okay?
Thanks, you too, Finnox. Bye.
Thank you for listening to Hack Republic Radio. HPR is sponsored by Caro.net, so head on over to caro.net for all your hosting needs.